Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. 80 years ago this week, Winston Spencer Churchill became Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. He did so after the previous Prime Minister lost support right across all parties in the House of Commons. Neville Chamberlain was forced to resign, ostensibly for his handling of the Norway campaign. The day Winston Churchill became Prime Minister, Adolf Hitler launched his massive assault on Western Europe, on France and the Low Countries. Within hours of the assault being launched, it was clear that Britain and France were up against a very different kind of challenge to the one they'd faced during the First World War, fast-moving German armoured thrust, a gigantic aerial bombardment, pounded defences, fast-moving German columns pushed at extraordinary speed all along the front, and in particular a gigantic undetected thrust through the Ardennes, through the hilly country of the Ardennes, prized open the back door to France and sliced the Allied armies in half. It was a catastrophe in the making. It was the grimmest first week of being a Prime Minister of any Prime Minister I can think of. Winston Churchill responded by making a series of speeches, a series of addresses in the House of Commons. They've gone down as some of the finest speeches in the history of the English language. It began 80 years ago this week with the speech that's become known as the Blood, Toil, Tears and Sweat speech, outlining his determination to secure victory at all and any cost. And it went on, the speeches about the finest hour and the few and all that kind of thing, as the sun went on and the Battle of Britain progressed. I was lucky enough to be given access to the House of Commons. I stood on the spot that Churchill made those speeches 80 years ago. We got a documentary featuring those speeches and my filming in the House of Commons coming out this week. That's available on History Hit TV. Remember, you go to History Hit TV, you get all the back episodes of this podcast, you get quizzes, you get live Zoom records like the one we had this week with historian Rutger Bregman, and you can join in on as a subscriber, and you also get wonderful history documentaries. If you want to go and check that out, watch the Churchill film, come and sit in on other wonderful historians as we record live podcasts, please go to historyhit.tv and use the code POD1, P-O-D-1. You get a month for free and then you get your first month for just £1, euro or dollar. You can check it out. To go along with the launch of that film, we've gone back into the archive for this podcast. We've got an archive of hundreds and hundreds of podcasts stretching all the way back to 2015 when I was a lad. And this is with Andrew Roberts, Churchill's best-known biographer. I went round to his house. He showed me lots of his Churchill memorabilia, and we talked about the career of one of the most remarkable, but in recent years, controversial statesmen in British history. Enjoy.
I feel the hand of history upon our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished. And liquidity.
One child, one teacher, one book, and one pen can change the world.
It must be you've written so many books about Churchill. Everyone's written so many books about Churchill. Do you think there's still more we can say about this man?
Fortunately, actually, yes, there is. Since the last major biography of him, there have been 41 sets of papers that have been deposited at the Churchill Archives in Cambridge, including really important things like his daughter's 1940 diary, Mary Soames's diary from 1940, which I think was wonderful. Her Majesty the Queen has allowed me to be the first Churchill biographer to read her father's diaries. And he had lunch with Churchill every Tuesday of the war, and they talked completely openly. The King trusted Churchill implicitly. He knew that he was one of the only people in public life who didn't want his job. he trusted him with the ultra secret, for example, and so he was very open to him. And luckily, the King then went and wrote down what Churchill had said. So there are new stories, new jokes, new anecdotes. There have been 45 speeches of Churchill's that have been discovered by researchers that aren't in the collected volumes that were brought together by Robert Rhodes James. So there too I've been able to quote from speeches of Churchill that nobody had quoted from in any previous biography. And we've also got the Mieske diaries, the diaries of Ivan Mieske, who was the Soviet ambassador to London from 1932 to 1943. And so, and he saw a lot of Churchill, especially in the key moments of the war in 1940 and 41, and wrote down everything Churchill said as well. So all in all, I don't think that necessarily it's going to be the case in 10 years' time, for example, because these are key areas and sources which have now slipped into place. But there is something new to say about Churchill on pretty much every page of my book.
What are you proudest of in terms of changing our perception of Churchill? I mean, what do you think? What does this biography really? What do all these new sources really add?
What they add really is to go back to what an extraordinary emotional man he was. One thinks of him as being probably more emotional than any of the other contemporary prime ministers, or indeed politicians of the day. He was driven by his emotions. He burst into tears 50 times during the war. Now imagine today if Mrs. May were to burst into tears. She has every right to, I hasten to add, but if she burst into tears in the House of Commons while making a speech, it would be something that would be rather sort of unsettling to everybody. Churchill was a romantic sort of 18th century figure trapped in a Victorian aristocrat's body. So I try to concentrate on that aspect of him. Another thing that the sources bring out is quite how frustrated and irritated he was in the early parts of the Second World War about the Americans. This is something, of course, that he couldn't say in public, but which you get from the King's diaries in particular, very strongly, that he couldn't believe that the Americans were taking so long to get into the war. And ultimately, of course, it took Hitler to declare war on America rather than the other way round. So that's a very powerful thing. Really, anything that's new about Churchill is in itself an exciting thing, and as I say, there's a lot.
The myth of Churchill is so powerful, and are we seeing new? Is what we're now seeing allowing us to take a sort of a more objective view? I mean, for example, on his leadership throughout the war, does the summer? This is extraordinary. Apotheosis in the summer of 1940 blind us to mistakes or other things earlier or later in the war?
I don't think it does. I think, of course he made mistakes. He made mistakes, terrible mistakes, all the way through his life. But he learnt from them. As he said, I should have made nothing if I had not made mistakes. He learnt from the First World War, he learnt not to overbear the chiefs of staff. He never once overruled them in the whole of the Second World War. He learnt not necessarily to trust to experts. That was partly as a result of the fact that the gold standard, which he went back onto in 1925, was a disaster, even though every expert had said that he should do it. He had this sense of a redemptive power, really, of being able to learn from his mistakes. Now, that's not to say he didn't continue to make mistakes in the Second World War, but they're far, far less important, it strikes me. It was wrong to have stood up for Greece and to have sent an army to Greece in 1941 because, of course, it had to evacuate a couple of months later. But nonetheless, he had very strong political reasons for doing it, and he argued those through in the House of Commons. Historians now agree that he shouldn't have done it. But he did it as a way... as he himself said, I will make mistakes, but in front of the enemy. He always said that his own generals would be let off, and admirals would be let off, if the mistakes they made were attacking ones. And with Churchill, they almost always were.
That's why he never gave Percival in Singapore.
That's right. Whereas he did let off Admiral Cunningham over the Dakar business. Yeah.
Why, with the Second World War and Churchill, every time I go anywhere in this country and walk into any pub or any museum, they say, this is Winston Churchill's favourite spy. Winston Churchill particularly wanted this to happen, he particularly wanted that to happen. You don't hear that about David Lloyd George in the First World War. I mean, did Churchill wield an unprecedented degree of influence and power over the British war effort? Or has it just become a sort of... His leadership has become a convenient sort of catch-all for everything that was going on.
Well, he made himself Minister of Defence, of course. This was the first thing he did when he became Prime Minister. So, and he reorganised the Chiefs of Staff Committee so that it only met with the Operations Committee of the Cabinet with politicians. So it was a reorganisation of Whitehall to give him power. But he was by no means a dictator of Britain during the Second World War. I mean, he couldn't get an operation past the Chiefs of Staff. He had to agree with them that it needed to be undertaken. The reason you don't get it in earlier wars, although you almost do a bit with Pitt the Younger in the Napoleonic Wars, is because in most of the wars, the generals have been allowed far too much power. We saw that in the First World War, the struggles between Lloyd George and Haig and Robertson and the rest of them were titanic struggles, but ultimately it was the soldiers who won. That's not the case in the Second World War.
How did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the History of Sex Scandal in Society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When in Churchill's later life, what did he... I mean, he was obviously very worried about... He promised that he would not preside over the
liquidation of the British Empire.
Liquidation of the British Empire, which is sort of what happened on his watch, isn't
it? No, it's not. He didn't give away any part of the British Empire in the second Indian Summer Premiership. He was under pressure to, but he very much knew that that was going to happen. But India had been given away by the Labour government, by the Attlee government, in the immediate post-war period, and between 51 and 55, he didn't give away any part of the empire. But it all went away fairly swiftly after that, especially, of course, after the Suez debacle.
But I guess my point is that later in life, did he feel that confronting and defeating Hitler was his greatest, was an achievement worthy of enormous, you know, he looked back with enormous happiness on that? Or did he feel strategically that the Britain that he had left was actually diminished from the Britain that he had arrived into as a politician?
Yes, absolutely the latter. He thought he had been a failure as a politician because of the way that the empire was disintegrating, and because he had gone into politics, as he wrote to his mother in 1896, in order to promote the interests of the British Empire in abroad and obviously social reform at home. And he did do an enormous amount of social reform at home, but as far as the foreign policy was concerned, he considered himself to have been a failure. And he never patted himself on the back particularly, not in speeches, not openly, about the Second World War. Of course, he wrote his six-volume history of the Second World War, in which he was the central figure, intentionally so. But he actually himself, and he told his private secretaries this in the post-war period, he thought that his career had been a failure because the empire that he loved and that he had dedicated his life to was collapsing.
What hope for the rest of us if Winston Churchill died feeling like a failure?
I know, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, we all appreciate that he was one of the greatest men in history, but yet he himself didn't.
Well, that's interesting. So on what grounds do we say that he's one of the greatest men in history? Is it just this unique identification and confrontation with Adolf Hitler and his evil brand of Nazism, or is it about his extraordinary Renaissance characteristics?
It's certainly the latter. The great thing about Winston Churchill is that he is so much more than just 1940 and 41. He's the man who creates the welfare state. He's the man who has who's an unbelievable believer in history. You know, he reads history, he writes history, and then he makes history. He is somebody who has advanced the English language to wonderful, sublime levels. He's somebody who reminds us that that just sheer animal courage, but actually moral as well as physical courage, is a good thing in a politician, in a statesman. He's somebody who has so much more to give than just the victories of 1940 and or at least the survival, not so much the victories even of 1940 and 41. And then you also, of course, have to look at all of the work that he did with the Chiefs of Staff in creating British Grand Strategy for 1942, 43, 44 and the victory in 1945. You know, this is not just a man who made great speeches in the House of Commons on in a 12-month period, by any means.
We've seen more recently Indian historians, other historians, reminding us of the Churchill's involvement in things that now appear to be you know, far less attractive. Mm. So imperialism, all that sort of stuff. You in the past have written books celebrating Napoleon, celebrating Churchill, unashamedly. And yet, somebody demonstrating Churchill's views towards race or towards empire now would be unacceptable in modern political discourse.
Unacceptable, yeah.
So how does that work?
More than unacceptable, obscene. I mean, it would be absurd and obscene to believe that white people were biologically superior to non-white people. But that is what the Darwinists took, or at least the neo-Darwinists took, to be a scientific fact back in those days, however absurd that might be today. People like Huxley believed that you could extend Darwinist principles to believe that one particular race of humans was superior to the other.
So for example, Napoleon, Churchill, these great men, what is their greatness today? Why should we think of them as great?
Oh, well, we see them as great, correctly, because of their extraordinary achievements. Napoleon dragged France into the 19th century. He brought about a true transformation of French society. Churchill, as well, of course, as having won the Second World War, also did things that transformed British society for the better. And so that's, I think, what you're looking for in a truly great person, somebody who has left granite-like alterations for the better in their own cultures and worlds.
Do you think in 100 years' time we will still... Churchill's reputation will endure?
I think Churchill's reputation will be higher in 100 years' time than it is now, because I think people will have got over the identity politics problems that they have with him. I don't think that that's something that's going to last for another 100 years, frankly. I think that people are going to be able to see everybody in their historical context. It's a bit like criticising Oliver Cromwell for not supporting socialised medicine. No, of course he didn't. You have to see people in their own historical context, or they are nothing. So I think, if anything, the capacity of Churchill, the sort of sheer, as you mentioned, Renaissance figure that he was, will be something which will be celebrated by Britons for many hundreds of years.
What is next for Andrew Roberts? If you've finished writing about Churchill, where do you go after Churchill?
That's the trouble, yes, exactly. I do sometimes feel that if I'm run over by a bus this afternoon, it's not going to matter terribly much because I'll have done my my best work. But historians, as you'll know, tend to get better as they get older. And so when you look actually at some of the historians who are writing at the moment who are in their 70s and 80s, and turning out some of the best stuff they've ever written. It's rather wonderful being in a profession which you can't retire from.
You say getting hit by a bus. The famous Churchill incident in New York. All of this, mate, you would have had to find a completely different thing to write about if it had been for that.
And actually, the scar that was left when he was hit by a car in December 1932 in Fifth Avenue in New York, and very nearly killed. I mean, of all the times that he nearly died, that was in the top three. And actually, you can see, if you look at the front page of my book, you can see this vivid scar that goes right the way up the centre of his forehead. It's a very powerful thing, and it used to go red during arguments with the chiefs of staff when General Brooke would be sitting looking across the green table down in the cabinet war rooms, breaking pencils in half. Churchill's scar would go a vivid red colour.
And bizarrely, Hitler was also hit by a car within months of that happening. Almost two of the extraordinary figures of the 20th century almost both killed in automobile accidents. Speaking of just on Alan Brooke, you mentioned that. Recently, people have said that Alan Brooke's diary is evidence that Churchill was sort of deranged mentally declining during the war and actually was more of a hindrance than anything. I mean, obviously, you completely disagree with that.
Disagree with that. No, absolutely. And actually, no policy, no strategy could have been adopted had it not been for the extraordinary creative tension between Churchill and the Chief of the Imperial General Staff, Lord Allenbrook. And the struggles between these two men are titanic. And when Allenbrook attacks Churchill in his diary, which he very often does, he's venting, he's letting off steam after a long day of struggle with Churchill. But think about what that struggle actually ultimately created. It created the Africa strategy, the Mediterranean strategy, the success at D-Day, crossing the Rhine, these great achievements, bringing the Americans into the overall British strategy. I mean, things that are world-shattering and world-changing. And those came as a result of this creative tension. But nobody ever for a moment denies that there was a lot of tension involved.
They're the Lennon and McCartney of British.
They were indeed, they were. And look what they created ultimately.
Right. Andrew Roberts, thank you very much. The book is called?
The book is called Churchill Walking with Destiny.
Good luck with it.
Thanks so much.
I feel the happy history upon our shoulders.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there. Law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.